General Katyal, welcome to the court.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Judge Lurie, may it please the court. Certain claims at issue here, most prominently claim one of the 282 patent, fall outside of what the Supreme Court in Chakrabarty called our patent law's expansive and wide view of patent eligibility. Chakrabarty said Section 101 includes, quote, anything under the sun that is made by man.
Counsel, you have this distinction in your brief that you argue, the distinction that I brought up with opposing colleague, not the cDNA one, that one I understand exactly where you're coming from on, but the whole gene versus the isolated segment. You, as I understand the government's position, think one would be unpatentable subject matter, but the other maybe not? Or should there be a distinction there? Tell me what you think.
So our test is literally, if you had almost a magic microscope, Judge Moore, that allowed you to zero in on the gene, and you would look down and you'd see, for example, chromosomes 17 and 13, and if you could see the exact claim to which the patent is being sought in nature, in that sequence, as claim one of 282 does, that itself is something that is a product of nature. And so that would be true if you had the microscope in a wider or a smaller zoom lens.
So the 50 nucleotides would be there, and therefore you think invalid.
If it were a 50 nucleotide sequence as to which the claim is being sought, yes, that is a product.
If there are 50 nucleotides with, let's say, the introns dropped out, then the answer is no.
That's exactly right, Judge Bryson, that the magic microscope wouldn't be able to find, for example, cDNA. You can look and you can look, but it wouldn't be there because it doesn't exist in nature. And that's why this is a very limited position. This is not a position that is going to dramatically undermine the biotechnology industry or destroy all of the patents that the amici are trying to say. That may or may not be true about the plaintiff's broader theory or Judge Sweet's opinion, but this is a theory that just simply says, look to whether or not the product is found in nature or not. As the Supreme Court in JEM said, the relevant test is between human-made inventions on the one hand and products of nature on the other hand.
But the claimed products here are not products of nature. They are bonded to other materials, correct?
That is correct.
Right. So they are not prohibited as being mere purified natural products.
Well, Judge Lurie, I think that's true about lots of different substances in the earth that I think would be patent eligible under their theory, starting with Judge Moore's example of the mineral, and then we could go to, for example, what our brief discusses, lithium, the third element on the periodic table, which exists in natural form in salts with covalent bonds accompanying other material. And only when it was isolated out in metallic form in 1818 were those bonds broken. But I think nobody would think that the third element of the periodic table is patentable simply because it doesn't exist in nature, because the covalent bonds of lithium attach to other substances. Similarly, there are other examples in our brief explaining why, for example, their theory would require, I think, patenting the isolated electron, which again doesn't occur by itself in nature. It occurs as part of an atom, and one could say, well, the ingenuity is, as Denman did by winning the Nobel Prize, in isolating out that electron and trapping it in the Penning trap. But that doesn't make a new invention. He has invented, as Judge Moore said earlier, a process for trapping, for isolating, and so on, but not actually, he hasn't invented the electron. And similarly, if someone discovers, for example, that the pollen of a certain flower cures cancer, that person has discovered the cure for cancer. They haven't discovered the pollen.
And as John Court said, that the claimed materials are simply conveyors of information. That may be true, but the claims don't read a method of conveying information. They claim substances. And whether they convey information or not, they are still substances, correct?
Absolutely, Judge Lurie.
Focus on the information was a wrong theory.
Absolutely, Judge Lurie. We're not here trying to defend the district court's judgment about information. I think the contours of that are very uncertain, and I think the district court's opinion wouldn't be a wise course to go down. Rather, I think what this court should do is what I think the Supreme Court has repeatedly said, that there's just a cardinal distinction for 101 purposes between products of nature on the one hand and human-made invention on the other. And the mere act of isolating a substance doesn't mean that it is a human-made invention. For it to be so, lithium would be patentable.
You've disavowed the information theory. Are you prepared to disavow the purification theory?
Well, it depends what one means by the purification theory.
It's not purification, as I indicated, of compound C, purifying it of any residual A and B. You're not purifying the gene here. You are making it by separating it from other covalently bonded materials.
Right. So, to the extent that a patent is being sought on A and B to produce compound C, we don't have any problem with that because so long as C doesn't exist in nature. Steel is a good example. Iron plus carbon equals steel. That is obviously patentable. But I think here, to the extent that in claim 1 of 282 and claim 1 of 492 do something different, they are saying this actual material exists in nature. That's the magic microscope that I was speaking of earlier. And if that exists in nature, that is where our line would be.
And your answer, I take it, to the covalent bond approach to asking if it appears in nature where the covalent bonds exist in nature and are broken through the purification / isolation, is lithium? Is the lithium type
is
example?
Is the lithium example? I would also
other
say
examples.
Well, I would say sure. I think uranium, for example, you have the same problem. When uranium is purified, it also breaks the bonds from 235 to 238, and the
like. We're probably getting into facts that aren't in the record. Whether we're
absolutely
talking about the metallic lithium or lithium carbonate.
Sure. And my only point is to say that this is a cardinal view about 101. The covalent bond argument hadn't been, to my knowledge, briefed. It's not before the briefs. It's not before you specifically, and I'm not sure that there is any precedent for the notion that covalent bonds are
relevant. But the inventors didn't purify the claimed gene, did they?
Excuse me?
The inventors didn't purify the claimed gene because it wasn't in the natural state contaminated with something. It was bound to other materials so that it was another material.
Right. If that's the way you've defined it, purify, I think that's right. Our simple point is whether you call it purification or isolation. Just look to, does this substance itself exist in nature? And Judge Bryson, to return to your question about covalent bonds, I think all that the covalent bonds theory would do is suggest that someone may be using a process to break bonds, to isolate a substance. But it doesn't answer the question, does that substance itself exist in nature or not, whether bonded to another material or not?
Part of my concern is, in the bigger picture, what about B12? What about antibodies? What about? There's about a million things I could thrust out at you right now that are antibodies exist in nature. Your body will produce them. But when you inject a little bunny and you make him produce the antibodies so you can inject him in a human being later on, those antibodies are not patentable. But we've got all these cases. I mean, granted, they're very old cases, but cases saying those things are patentable.
But Judge Moore, I think overwhelmingly the body of early cases goes the other way. The Martin cases, the Mertz case, and so on, all suggest that mere isolation or purification of a substance that exists in nature is not patentable. And as we turn the clock forward to today and think, what is the real-world implication? The examples that they've cited all boomerang on them. For example, they talk about Taxol. Well, Taxol is not a product. The bark of the yew tree, that product was not, the composition was not patented. Only the process was patented. And that, I think, goes to the fundamental point, which you were getting at earlier, which is process patents are, of course, okay in this area and will provide the correct incentives and the like. The relevant question is, has someone, by inventing a process, somehow invented the substance itself? That's the flower example and the pollen that I said earlier. And so I don't think that this is some dramatic theory that undoes things. I think, frankly, every example that is in the briefs, aspirin and the like, turns out
well,
to not.
This is not a dramatic theory that undoes things. The PTO has been allowing these patents for 35 years. Mm-hmm. I think that this is a pretty dramatic theory that would undo a lot of existing patents.
Well, I certainly didn't mean to say that it doesn't undo things in the area of DNA. I was responding to the other types of area, the other places around. Now, with respect to that, the PTO, as our brief at pages 6 and 18 acknowledges, has granted patents for isolated DNA. Now, the vast majority of those patents are for cDNAs, recombinant DNAs, process claims and the
but
like.
But they have guidelines, and the guidelines clearly address this point, and the PTO guidelines conclude that this is, the very thing you're arguing now is not patentable subject matter, are patentable subject matter. And I notice those guidelines have not been pulled down off the website. They continue to be the view of the PTO. So while you're here representing the government, I'm not sure what that really means, because it seems like we have a split in the government.
So if I could address that for a moment. There are, of course, the utility guidelines that were issued in 2001. And after Judge Sweet's decision in this case, as well as a concurrence by a member of this court last year in the Intervet case, we took the U.S. government as a whole, including the PTO, took a comprehensive look for the first time at this whole question about DNA and what is and is not patentable, a high-level comprehensive review. And in the course of that, we decided two things. First, that the majority of what the PTO has been doing, the vast, vast majority, has been absolutely appropriate. That is, patents on cDNAs, processes, recombinant DNAs, and the like. With respect to the area of isolated DNA, we do think that the PTO is wrong, and it is the U.S. government's position that opinion that we couldn't write a brief that allowed the patentability of isolated DNA. For to do so would be to make lithium patentable, uranium, coal from the earth, and a whole variety of other substances, perhaps even base individual nucleotides. And we just couldn't do that, despite the fact that we give not just the thumb on the scale, but the elbow on the scale to the Patent and Trademark Office and to our client agencies as we are trying to evaluate and come to a position. It was just impossible to do, given the Supreme Court's clear guidance in Chakrabarty and JEM, that there is a fundamental distinction in 101 between human-made inventions on the one hand and products of nature on the other.
I guess my question kind of goes to a notion of stare decisis. About has Congress has never spoken to this. 101 is broad. To the extent there are exceptions, they're judicially created. And I get a little nervous expanding the umbrella in light of 35 years of industry development, in light of the fact that there's clearly a split within the executive on this point. You know, the PTO has adopted over many years a single position, and now, 35 years after that started, here we have a different position by the government. So why isn't stare decisis a concern? Why shouldn't Congress figure this out, not us?
Absolutely, and I'm here as a friend of the court that we went through exactly the same process and asked exactly that question. And ultimately, like Chakrabarty and Bilski, we said, this is really a fundamentally legal question. And the Supreme Court has taught us time and time again in Rapanos and Solid Waste that congressional acquiescence alone should be the basis by which you adhere to a prior position, particularly on a pure question of law. This is a pure question of law, and to defer to the 35 or so years of what has happened before really is to undo one of the central tenets of what 101 is about, the distinction, core distinction between products of nature and human-made invention.
General,
is it fair to say that you would take issue with the Park Davis case, Judge Hand's 1911 decision?
I think ultimately our theory probably would in the extreme. I don't think you need to get to it here because what Judge Hand said there is if the purification created a different substance that was so different in kind that it did something differently, then that would be patent eligible.
Well, but and what is your position with respect to that?
With respect to that, certainly claim one of 282 and 492, the DNA has the exact same function in and out of the body. Now, with respect to Judge Moore's question about primers, I think it is fair to say that there is something of a difference in function when primers are taken out of the host cell. I don't know that, and again, this goes to the ultimate reasoning of Judge Hand. I think at the end of the day, if the court were to follow that, it would be saying that differences in function alone are enough, and that would make coal patent eligible, isolated electron, lithium, gold, all the things have a different function when isolated out.
So you're uncomfortable with the, if it's purified enough to create a functionally different, in other words, I even think aspirin may be a case in which, if I recall the aspirin patent dispute, the original substance had too much of the salicylic acid that had upset the stomach and the invention was to get the purified acetic salicylic acid, which doesn't upset the stomach, and that was considered patentable by virtue of the elimination of the impurity. But you seem to be uncomfortable with that.
I do think that I am ultimately uncomfortable with it. I don't think the court needs to go there for purposes of claims right. 1 of 282 and 492. With respect to aspirin, I do think that that's not correct, that aspirin was created by treating salicylic acid, which is a naturally occurring substance,
right.
with acetic anhydride. And so it was a combination of two things with respect to aspirin. It wasn't a naturally occurring product. Aspirin would be okay under our test, under our magic microscope test.
Thank you, General Caprio. Mr. Castanis has some rebuttal time.